Okay, we'll get started. I just turned on the recording. Last week we had our first session on my recent pilgrimage to Egypt. I was sharing with people a good background, the scriptures, the timeline, and all of that is recorded, and including today's talk, and we'll give that freely to people. Contact Francis if you'd like a link. I've created a PowerPoint movie, so you don't have to have a PowerPoint application. You can play it on any device, stop it at any point, and I think that'll be helpful to you. We ended last week with a question, and the question really was, if you were a first century missionary, how would you share the good news of Christ with the Egyptians? And I mentioned that our local Egyptian guide, Migo, he is a Coptic deacon, and he said all the ancient history of Egypt, it really made Egypt fertile ground when St. Mark the Evangelist came there in the first century after Pentecost and shared the good news of Christ with the Egyptian people. And so we were kind of pondering, well, what is it in ancient Egypt history, which is all of the pyramids and everything that we saw, why would that make it fertile ground and connections? And obviously any missionary tries to make connections with the local people and with their culture. Not that you can embrace everything, but you look for things that you can connect with. And some things maybe you connect with, and maybe you even continue in your understanding of the gospel. I didn't see it, but last week I think it was shown the movie Orthodox Alaska at St. Peter and Paul Church. And certainly the missionaries to Alaska did that with the native people when they came, and that's why there continues to be blessed in Alaska. The existence of totem poles, and if you go to the cemeteries, you see little buildings on top of some of the graves. And so some of their culture, if it's not totally antithetical to Christ, if it can be incorporated, you do that as points of contact, affirming what you can. And so I'm sure the early missionaries found much that they could affirm in terms of some things in the ancient Egyptian tradition, mythology, practices. So most important would be a desire for life after this life, preparation for a life beyond. That's the whole point of all the pyramids and everything. And I can't help but contrast that with American society today, or modern Western civilization, that tends to just sort of live for now. We don't even think about the life to come. And we're not prepared for it spiritually. We don't even think, how could we be prepared for it? We just kind of have some kind of wishful thinking. If you believe anything is after death, that would be very antithetical to the early Egyptians. That's antithetical to our basic Christian faith. We're here on this earth to prepare for a life to come, to live our lives in such a way that when our bodies die, our souls can continue and ultimately make that great journey to be with God in a heavenly and a holy and a happy place. So, I mean, that's one of the obvious. Father Raphael came up last week at the end of the class, and he pointed out this seal. The seal is from King Hezekiah. Hezekiah lived in 715 to 686 in Judah. Jewish king after Solomon and after David. And notice there's the Ankh symbol, the Egyptian symbol of life on it. So even at this point, in Hezekiah, Israel had many bad kings. He was a good one. He was one of the good kings. But he could embrace something of that Egyptian culture, and it shows that it had been passed down. And then you also find also this disc in the middle with wings extended. Last time I told you that a very common motif in Egyptian imagery is sort of the outstretched wings covering you. And you think of the Psalms, God covers us with his wings. And God is seen as primarily the sun in ancient Egyptian mythology. So you're bringing together some elements that could be embraced that maybe in a positive way. So that's just one example from history of people in the time of Hezekiah doing that. Okay, let's move on. We ended in Luxor last time, and just the fun, it was really a fun thing. We had this balloon ride, and let's see, it was really wild. Sadly, it doesn't, you don't hear the roar. I didn't set up the sound, but wow, it was a really amazing thing. And then we go over the ruins in Luxor, and we see Karnak, and we see also Valley of the Kings. It was really neat. I recommend it. Let's see, we'll go on then. I gotta stop this. I keep trying to get my technology figured out, but okay, there we go. Just more of the balloon ride. There was a wonderful picture there of a little boy in the field with a falcon. But above the falcon, there's some power lines. So that was a little scary point. I asked people to pray for me when I went to Egypt, and your prayers were heard. If I would play this where you hear the audio, these men are speaking Arabic in a really frantic kind of tone as they're pulling on our balloon. And later we discovered, oh, it's the power lines. But thank God we made it fun. Oh, there they are. There we go. Valley of the Kings. At some point, Egypt, well, we know when, after the pyramid period, roughly speaking, 1600 years before Christ at least, they stopped having pyramids because of grave robbers. So they began burying in tombs that would be shafts down into the ground. And that's where you'd find now the pharaoh is buried. But there would be maybe a funeral house where they could have their preparation and then go from there to the burial sites. And this is a famous one in the Valley of the Kings. Inside, as you go down these shafts into where the kings are buried, the pharaohs, it was really amazing. There we go. We see very vivid colors. So a lot of the colors in the external outside ruins are faded, but when you go underground, you can see how vivid they still are. And this picture doesn't even do it justice. The actual tombs here in the middle, it's kind of like a Russian doll where you have multi layers. So the outer layer would be made of stone or concrete, very hard to get the top off. But then you do that, then the next layer may be of wood, and then another layer, and finally you get down to the gold sarcophagus, and that's where you'd find the actual mummy of the pharaoh, and then wrapped up there. There's again that wing symbol up here. And here's a pharaoh being escorted in the underworld by the god Horus and a god of the underworld. I forget that god's name in Egypt mythology. But Horus has an interesting mythological story. Almost every Egyptian, ancient Egyptian, would have known that story, that it's the story, it's the mythology of Osiris. That was his father. Osiris was murdered by his brother. You know, you think about that, Cain and Abel. Murdered by his brother, and unfairly, and his brother usurps him, and then the wife of his father was the goddess Isis. And so she is able to resurrect her dead husband. So they have a resurrection mythology. And then from that resurrection, then Horus is born, who becomes a god. Well, you can begin to think about that again if you're a first century missionary. Hey, resurrection of the dead, it shouldn't be anything new to you. That's part of your ancient mythology. There is life beyond, and even if you're dead, you can be, even your body can be resurrected, and from that, then wondrous things can happen. So, connecting the dots, I mentioned the history of our faith. Abraham went to Egypt, and then after Abraham, we know there was Joseph, and after Joseph, big biblical figure is Moses. In between Joseph and Moses, it says in Exodus, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. So, Joseph was in favor of the Pharaoh, and he was like a prince of Egypt, like a governor. And up here you see they were settled in this region called the Delta or Goshen. And so they were doing well for a long period of time, and they were probably mingled with this ancient people from Canaan and Mesopotamia called the Hyksos people from last week. We discussed that. And Hyksos, Hebrews, the Hebrews are part of that group. So they grew in numbers, they prospered, but soon they became a threat. And so this Pharaoh decided, enough of the threat, we're going to drive out the Hyksos, we're going to kill them. And there are some that remained, the Hebrews obviously remained, and probably his view of it, we don't want them anymore to grow in number or to be a threat to us Egyptians. And so he made the ones that remained there slaves. I checked with Migo, our Egyptian guide, and he said most of the scholars believe this was indeed the Pharaoh that knew not Joseph. Amus is his name, Amus the First. And you can literally see this very mummy of him in the Luxor Museum. I saw it. And the face is leathery, and I was surprised how all of these mummies of pharaohs, how small they were. You know, you read about in the Bible, mighty and everything, but they were small. And at this point, very obviously weak and powerless. So this is the Pharaoh that enslaved the Hebrew people, seeing them as foreigners, seeing them as a threat. So, okay. I mentioned tombs that you'd see, not just underground, but some tombs were actually in the hills and caves. And so we walked to some of these. And some of those later were converted into churches. The Christians didn't seem afraid. They just occupied these places, especially in times of persecution. And the church has always been persecuted in Egypt. And so this is a remnant of a church. They turned a little apse for an altar area that would have been right there. And on the wall across. So going back to the ancient Egyptians, this was a close-up of the Valley of the Kings, where they would prepare the bodies and kind of like a funeral chapel. And this is all now like 50 years after Akhenaten. I told you last week about his efforts to teach, instead of polytheism, to teach monotheism, and to worship one God who would be compared in his mind the rays of the sun. You know, again, you think about, you know, Christian understanding of our God, Father and Son, and essence and energy, and his efforts at reform failed, and after his death, his son, famous son, King Tut, everybody's heard of King Tut, that was his son, and he turned against his father, he reversed all the policies of his father, had his father's images removed, and it would have, almost by accident, we know about Akhenaten, because the political press in Egypt, they liked to be very censoring and remove people that were unpopular and they didn't want people to think about them or talk about them. But we do know about Akhenaten and his reforms. And that was, you wonder, was he influenced by the Hebrews? Was he influenced by Joseph? You know, so, but 50 years after him, then they go back to the old ways of paganism. And here, as you go through some of these tombs, you'll see, you know, again, the symbol of Isis. I mentioned Isis, the mother goddess, So female, so they emphasize not just God male, but female. And the female goddess always had this cow horn. See it in her throne. So it's not a bull, it's a cow. And you think of a nurturing figure when you think of a cow and giving milk. And you also see the disk of the sun in there. So think about that again as you're a missionary, trying to help people understand the fullness of truth versus, you know, false ideas, but maybe that are getting at something. Just like St. Paul went to the Greeks on Mount Athos and proclaimed, you see here a statue to an unknown God. I want to tell you who this unknown God is. That's what St. Paul did. So think of the early missionaries trying to do that with the Egyptians. And and she's the one who brought back her dead husband to life. I'll move on. This is another temple we visited. You probably have seen in movies, these hidden chambers. We literally had to crawl upstairs and go inside. Not everybody felt able to do it, but old 70-year-old Father David did. Climb the stairs, I had to get down on my back and crawl into this little cavern here. And it was wonderful. I don't regret it at all. And somebody took my picture. But you'd see little chambers and very kind of secret places. And then some of it, again, inside, you'd see more color. So the Egyptians liked turquoise, and they mined turquoise in the Sinai Desert, along with many of the other precious things they mined in Sinai. So along the Nile, it's flat, but in the Sinai, especially mountainous, and you'll see a picture of that later. This is a creation icon, and look at the hands extending. I say icon, a creation image, up in the ceiling. So you'd be looking up at that, and again, thanks to the hands of the Creator. And they had on the top of this temple a place for ceremony, kind of a joining of heaven and earth, as a union, and once a year a big festival and all their festivals go on for a week. So it's not like feast days today in the Western world. You know, December 25th is Christmas, December 26th is over. That's not the way we Orthodox celebrate Christmas. We celebrate it for a whole week. We celebrate Pascha for a whole week, Bright Week. We celebrate the whole 40 days after our Lord's resurrection. The ancients did we do what the ancients did, and we celebrate for a week, a period of time. So this is a sacred bull, and that's also, you'll find these bulls that were mummified and even buried. I don't know how they did it. And you think about how hard it is to carry a big bull and to carry it underground and create stone coffins for the bull, but they did. And that was another kind of part of their religion. And I think that became a part also of the cult of Baal in the Old Testament. So some of these things you see, you know, again, some connections. Karnak Temple is very famous. Over 30, and this is in Luxor, over 30 pharaohs added to it from its early stages. So you, when you look at something, you wonder which period of its development was it. But it was really amazing. And here's another temple, Temple of Ramses III, who came after Ramses II, who I'm identifying as the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And this is probably the last great Pharaoh. They start a decline after this. The gap, the way they built these temples, this is very traditional. And this is to show the flood of the Nile, raising the level of the Nile, and then it sinks, and then it rises again. So the kind of ebb and flow of the Nile. But we were told this point in the middle, they designed these things so well that only twice a year, the spring and the fall equinox, they knew their astronomy and calculated it perfectly to match the building. The sun would appear right here at sunrise. And guess who would show up right at that moment? The Pharaoh, who would be then seen by the people as a son of God. And so that shows again their knowledge. I mentioned that a lot last week. Don't see these as primitive people that didn't know a lot, Neanderthals. No, these were very knowledgeable people who knew their astronomy. And later we'll see even at the temple in Ramses II, not the third, but the second, which is also, they had to reconstruct it because it was flooded underwater. And when they employed the best German engineers today to try to get things just right, and they could not do this. They only came up with one equinox showing up between. So it shows the knowledge and the skills of the early Egyptians. This is, we call it an Egyptian taxi. You go around in these little carriages pulled by a horse. If you visit the movie online, you'll see this is shown where they're actually moving. And you see little scenes from Luxor. Okay, there's again the motif of the wings spread out. And going into the temple, you notice there's one area, another area, and another area. So that would represent three chambers. So there's a holy place, and then there's a holy of holies. You see that over and over. So when we think in the Orthodox Church, think of the Temple of Solomon, and before Solomon's Temple, the Tabernacle in the Wilderness, the curtains that separated the different areas. And only the priest goes into the Holy of Holies, and only that once a year. So that was carried over. Just this is, again, revealed to the Egyptians when it was taught to Moses how to build the tabernacle and build the temple. That same various chambers are there. And in the Orthodox Church today, you see the same thing in our architecture. We have a narthex, we have a holy place, and then we have the Holy of Holies, the place of the altar. So there's a pattern in all of this that you can say and make connections with. It's moving. Okay. There we go. Luxor Temple which is also a famous temple in Luxor, besides Karnak. This is interesting. They had a festival every year that went on for about 10 days. And this temple is right on the Nile River. This picture doesn't do it justice. That's the Nile River. And so they would bring this statue of their god carried on these poles. And there's a big statue. And all the people would be assembled because it's a great celebration. And they would carry it on the Nile River, get off at the coast, and then walk down this, it's a row of sphinx all the way to enter the Luxor temple, which would be right here. Huge images, you can see the feet here of some of these statues. And then carry it into, ultimately, the Holy of Holies. If you listen to this online, you'll hear my commentary that only the priests, though, could enter the temple. And that's true of all the ancient temples, even the Jewish temple, only the priests. So the people are left outside, but they're outside celebrating. So that's where there would be a sacrifice, meat distributed, and food and drink and festivity that would go on, while inside the religious rites are going on, and basically kind of renewing order and renewing fertility. That theme of fertility is very important because we want things to continue and the earth to be fruitful and people to be fruitful. Okay, next one. There's a close-up, just a panorama of what it was like inside. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Ready now for it. Hit my button. There it is. Abba Simbel. This is in, we've gone now further south from Luxor all the way to the border of the Sudan. And this is where Abba Simbel Temple is. And it was a grand temple built for Ramses II, whom I'm identifying as the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And he was known, he had this title, the Great. And you can just see great in terms of the size of this. There's a man. How many men would it take to go up to that? And then inside you see Ramses depicted with his, you know, big shaft ready to kill an enemy and other enemies under his feet already defeated. And there's a picture of chariot. You know, remember the Exodus story? Their chariots were sunk in the sea. This is from the Egyptian Museum, what one of the chariots looked like. And there is a mummy of Ramses. I saw his mummy in the Museum of Civilization in Cairo, as well as others. Other mummies. They wouldn't let us take pictures at that place as we go down. We went underground to see it. But our guide, Migo, assured us at least one of these we know was the Pharaoh that Moses dealt with. And as I've been able to kind of put the dots together, I believe that was Ramses. More of this we see outside how huge it really is. And Migo here, our guide, is talking about the Exodus, and I'm going to show you a map and talk about it. It might be easier for you to understand. And here's a golden calf that was in the museum at Aswan.
Is it really gold?
Really gold. Yeah, they're beautiful. And you know, you wonder, okay, why a calf? When they were tempted and Aaron said, give me your gold, they'd taken the gold from Egypt and they make a golden calf. Again, a calf is sort of a nice god. when you think about it that way. Nurturing, giving milk, and God is nurturing, God feeds us. And so I always wondered in that story, I mean, we clearly know it wasn't right what they were doing. They sinned against God by doing that, but Aaron didn't really receive much of a punishment from it. It's kind of a strange story in the Bible. But because they have carried with them some of this Egyptian thinking, and they're not yet purified. They don't have the fullness of truth yet. There's a picture of the water there by Abba Simbel. I think I have another final slide to show that. This is showing some of the water.
Father David.
Yep.
So that looks more like a ram than a calf.
Maybe it's a ram. It looked like a calf to me.
Well,
yeah.
It's a domesticated animal, you know?
Yeah.
God is not domesticated by us.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
What's that on top of its head, Father?
Some kind of crown. I don't know. You know, they would always put crowns on top of the Pharaoh. So I don't know what kind of crown that would be. There's a nice picture of this is the famous Lake Nasser, where they built the Aswan Dam. And that's why they had to reconstruct Abba Simbel at that point, because it was actually buried under the water. And it's an amazing achievement in terms of engineering. So here's a map of the Exodus. If you listen to it online, you'll hear our guide Migo talk about it. But this is the land of Goshen. And so they crossed right about here, where it's very narrow. It's also technically called the Reed Sea, as opposed to this called the Red Sea. So the Bible sometimes, I think, calls it the Reed Sea, sometimes the Red Sea, but that's because it was very green and lush, and more likely you could imagine this is clearly where Pharaoh and his army with those chariots would get bogged down. But God still did the miracle, allowing the Hebrews to pass through on dry land, and all of the Egyptians are killed there. And some of their things then washed ashore that the Hebrews could use later as spoils of victory. Just a little aside, I don't know if you know, Netflix has a movie called Moses. Linda and I watched a few episodes of it. I think it's a 3-episode series. And if you have Netflix, you just for curiosity, you might like to watch it. It is Hollywood, so it's not altogether accurate the way we see things. And they borrow from all kinds of sources. You know, some of it is Islamic and some of it is Jewish Midrash. So it's not just straight out of the Hebrew Bible. But still, I thought it was interesting. Okay, now there's Abba Simbel again, what it looked like. Oh, back to this map. So after they cross the Red Sea, then they need water and they go down to this, and it's a dot. It's the Springs of Moses right on the coastline. And Migo pointed out that it's highly unusual. The Red Sea would be salt water, that you would have a well right by the Red Sea, and that's where it is, that has fresh water, not salt water. And God provided that. So it all fits the story. And then they go down from there south. And then here, this is where the Ten Commandments are given. It's the Mount Sinai. St. Catherine's Monastery is there, one of the oldest monasteries in the world. And there, from there they go north and then down again, and then finally up to Jordan. And this is Mount Nebo, where Moses looks over and he sees the Promised Land. 40 years they were in the desert, God providing for them. And then it would be Joshua who leads them on into the Promised Land. That's a picture of a symbol with the water there now, that the dam has created, this lake. After the Exodus, and they get into Canaan, they conquer it, and they're established, kingdom of first the judges, and then David, and then Solomon. Interesting, Egypt appears again in the year 921 BC, and here it's King Solomon. It's in 1 Kings 11:4. Solomon sought thereafter to kill Jeroboam. Jeroboam is this kind of rebel renegade living in Judah, and so he flees to take refuge in Egypt. And Shishak is the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh at that time. And he stays there, Jeroboam, until the death of Solomon. And then the story picks up in 2 Chronicles 12:2. Now Rehoboam, who is Solomon's son, he is now the king of Judah. And you think he's gotten information from this renegade Jeroboam, so he invades. He comes with 12,000 chariots, 60,000 horsemen, and they bring Israel, Judah, to their knees. And they take away treasures from the house of the Lord. Solomon had built a temple, and it was golden. They take the treasures from the temple, the gold house of the king, the shields of gold, and they have to replace it with bronze, a much lesser material. And why does God allow this, you can ask. You go back to Deuteronomy. This is Moses' kind of farewell sermon to the people. Behold, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. A blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God, which I command you this day, a curse if you do not obey. So blessing and curses. A lot of people look at the history of Israel and say, they're God's chosen people, God's blessings, it's irrevocable, so they're always blessed. Whoever Israel fights, they should win. Well, they don't know their Bible. Sometimes God lets them be defeated because they've turned away from the Lord. And then people that were once cursed, then God uses them and can bless them. So blessing and curses are not irreversible. It's conditional, and it depends on our choices, just like Moses says. God's desire is to save us all, but sometimes he has to judge us in the middle of that in order to then we learn our lessons, and then God is ultimately able to save us. This story from 921, it's told the same Pharaoh is in Karnak's temple, and here's a little drawing of it, and Migo pointed out that the Shishak, who was Pharaoh then, all his accomplishments are listed. And during this time, they note in history, Israel had this great influx of, I mean, Egypt had a great influx of gold. And the gold came, just as the Bible said, from the temple. Okay, comments, questions before we move on? We'll go then next to the first century, and we'll look at the story of the Holy Family.
How wide was the Red Sea and the cross?
Were they? I don't know the answer, Sasha. How wide was the Red Sea was Sasha's question. I don't know. Steve just got out his... You can look it up. That's what I do. I Google things and with my questions, and you should get the answer. But I don't know.
Father, so
Yeah, it's a real temple, the Temple of Ramses II at Abba Simbel, but it's where they built this dam, because the Nile was always having huge floods, and they thought it was a real waste of water and it was problematic, so we'll create this dam. But by building the dam, they knew they were going to flood all these ancient sites, including this most marvelous temple. So the engineers behind this and UNESCO figured out, before you flood it, let us cut it in pieces. And they literally cut it in pieces, and again employed German engineers to figure out what kind of tools and heavy equipment they needed and how to put it back together. And they put it together right back on the shore, exactly like you would have seen it in its original location, which is just slightly underwater. But it would be oriented the very same way, So you should still see the sun hitting it just like in the ancient.
So was it made of like big bricks or it was just all
huge stone bricks, huge. Okay. Amazing how they did it.
I think it was originally the stone was sandstone. So it was a whole lift of sandstone that they carved it out.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Okay. I think I can do the Holy Family. I'll try that next. So now we go to the first century. Mary and Joseph, we know from the Bible, with the baby Jesus, wicked King Herod wanted to kill Jesus and kill all the babies because they were a threat to him, there'd be a new king. And so they had to flee. And we know they stayed in Bethlehem and Jerusalem at least through the presentation of the temple, which would be 40 days after his birth. But then shortly after those 40 days, they go to Egypt. And that's quoted in one of the early scriptures, and I think maybe slide 2 from last week. In their journey, they stayed in different places. They were kind of on the run. And this is one of the first places they stayed, in Cairo, which was ancient Memphis. It's also ancient city of Babylon they built in Egypt, so it kind of has these different names. And this old church here is St. Sergius and Bacchus. It's built over the place where the Holy Families went. And you can see, I think I'll get the video going. Yeah, that's a well where Joseph and Mary drank from, and then we have to go downstairs to the location of the lower level. There's the well they drank from, and it's still there, preserved. And you know, you think, well, how do you know? Holy tradition, because they pass on from generation to generation, this is the spot, and they reverence it, and they build churches over it, and they rebuild churches over it. So, it's trustworthy to me. And then down at the lowest level, this is where there's like a cave and an altar there.
Father?
Yes?
Was there water there now?
There's water there now. You can see like bubbles.
Yeah.
That's water bubbles. So the water, so the well is still producing water.
Did he drink it?
No, they didn't have anything there to drink it. So. Generally, you don't drink water in Egypt. It's kind of like going to Mexico. So, we always drink bottled water. Now, if you have a lot of faith, if it's holy water, okay, well, do it with your own faith. So, I know when I went to the Holy Land, I came back sick because I drank from the Good Samaritan well. Maybe that wasn't the place where I got sick. But anyway, I got sick. So this time I wasn't going to drink from local water, even blessed water. So there's an old icon in this church of the Holy Family, Joseph and Mary. Again, the picture doesn't do it justice. Look at it on the video that'll be posted online. You can see it much better. It's beautiful.
How old is that icon?
I don't know. I know the church is 4th century. And I'm not sure if that icon goes back to the beginning. Mine. Okay, here's the Holy Family. And this map shows kind of their journey. So they come down the coastline. And this is the most traveled route. And they're a little bit inland. And, you know, in the news today, Gaza, they came down through Gaza. And there's the ancient city of Rafa. Right there. And so this was their journey. So, you know, wherever God goes to a land, that land is blessed. And then they come down, they kind of go this route back up into the Delta region, and then they go down. I didn't realize this. They go down the Nile River pretty far. Probably not as far as Luxor, but halfway, at least halfway between Cairo, which would be here, and Luxor down here. And one of these places they stopped, the tradition they built, this was a cave where they stayed, and miraculously, even the baby Jesus held up his hand when a rock was about to fall on them from a cliff, and the rock stopped. So that's one of the reasons this site is very special to the Egyptian Christians. They gather here from all over Egypt once a year to have a week-long celebration. And this town, this little town, is entirely a Christian town. It's a Muslim country, but there's still 10% of the population of Egypt is Christian. And all the Christians come to this little town to commemorate this. And there's a beautiful mosaic icon of them traveling and the water behind. And this Migo here is telling the story of this cave. You can listen to it online. And going inside this cave, they have this altar, and people leave prayer requests. That's what all these are. And I suppose the Coptic priests there take them and pray for them. This is kind of the cliff. You see beautiful farmland below, and what doesn't show up so well would be the Nile River right there. There we go. At this same place, this old church, 4th century, we all know the story of St. Helena, who visited the Holy Land and found things and built churches. She also commissioned this very church at this very location to be built, commemorating the Holy Family coming to Egypt. And it's a beautiful old stone church. Wow. Let's see here. It's wood here, the iconostasis, the columns are old stone. Here it shows we have to go in through metal detectors to enter the church. That's true of all the Coptic churches. Migo's telling the story of his church. And there, up here, you see worshipers are coming out before we go in. This was a daily liturgy. I was surprised how many people were there. Simple people from the village. There's an old man with the staff, and I was dressed, you know, as I am now in black, and they were coming up to me asking for abuna, for a blessing. So it was a very beautiful and warm visit that we had. There you can see better the old church. Their holy place with a curtain covering it. 4th century. This is old stuff. Okay, this might be our place to stop, I think so, today. Yep, there we go. So a taste of what's coming next week. So this was 1st century. Now we'll skip ahead to we're talking about the Holy Family visiting 1st century. Now we'll go to the Desert Fathers. The Desert Fathers come on the scene around in the 300s, so 4th century. And this is what it looks like as we were driving to the first monastery, which is by the Red Sea. So people are wondering, there's the real Red Sea. I don't know how far that is to the other shore. But that would be, one of the more narrow points, because this is north. And then over on this side, you see the mountainous area and clouds, and you can see why they would have caves up in those areas, and that's where we'll find St. Anthony. So we'll pick up next week with Desert Father, St. Anthony, St. Paul, and visiting some of those holy places and talking about the Desert Fathers. Questions before I break? Anyone?
Is it just all Coptic churches, or is there any
You will see next week when we visited Cairo a the main Greek Orthodox church dedicated to St. George. Yeah, that's the cathedral church, and we visited there. But I would say all the other churches we visited are Coptic. Yeah, including the monasteries, they're all now Coptic monks that are there. There are Catholics there. My roommate, it was a doctor from Atlanta, a very pious layman, a Catholic, and he wanted to go to Mass every day, and he struggled. But in Cairo, he had no problem. He'd get up real early and find daily Mass. But then after that, I'm not sure, one day he was kind of got to go a little bit. I think that was in Luxor. There was a church there. But, yeah, they have Catholic churches, as well as Chalcedonian Orthodox, and that's us, if you want. We're not in full communion with the Coptic Church. In my early notes, I said, I really believe we're of the same faith as the Coptic Christians. But we do not share communion together. So the unity still doesn't exist all the way in terms of sharing communion, even though on both sides, I think we'd say we believe the same thing, and the ancient thing that separated us was just terminology that sadly hasn't been overcome yet. So they're wonderful, wonderful Christian people, and it's an ancient church, and so we're so close. And that's like today, if somebody comes from the Coptic Church and we receive them by a confession, they're not re-chrismated or anything. We just, they make a confession and they're part of us, take communion. Anyone else? Thank you, I have enjoyed it. And thank you for allowing me to present. And we'll finish it next week. We'll talk about the monasteries and the churches. And I think you'll find it very inspiring.
Thank you.
Thank you.